You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Stuart Butler. I'm a senior fellow in economic studies here at the Brookings Institution, and I want to welcome you all to Brookings for this discussion on a reform agenda for the federal budget process. I want to remind you all that this is being webcast, and so if you would just take a moment right now to either close off your phone, turn off your phone, or silence it, that would be very much appreciated. We're pleased to be co-hosting this event with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, and the committee's President, Myra McGuinness, will be moderating the panel that will take place in the second part of the program. Myra and I and the other members of the panel are members also of the National Budgeting Roundtable that meets here monthly. And this is a bipartisan group of budget experts, former budget officials, and political scientists who focus on the budget process and how to reform it, including how to achieve reform through the political process itself. And we do this because we, like most people, recognize that the budget process is a mess. It's a process marked by missed deadlines, by crises and deadlock, and meanwhile, it seems to be unable to tackle many of the critical problems facing our country and pursuing our national goals. And this failure, I think, contributes to the profound, deep public suspicion and distrust of Washington that we've seen in the election and before that. But fortunately, some people are trying to do something about this. And so I'm delighted to welcome to Brookings Dr. Tom Price, who is chairman of the House Budget Committee, to keynote this event. This afternoon, he will be unveiling a set of draft proposals for a structural reform of the budget process and the way Congress enacts and puts into place budget for the United States. Chairman Price is a physician. He's represented Georgia's 6th District since 2005. And since January of 2015, he has been chairman of the House Budget Committee. As chairman, he's been strongly committed to budget process reform. In fact, in this Congress, he's held 9 hearings on the topic before presenting these proposals today, which have involved dozens of witnesses. And indeed, this strong commitment to budget process reform is why he is here with us today, despite having a few other things on his mind, as you might imagine. As you know, Dr. Price was nominated just yesterday to be the next Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Price, I know your schedule is very tight. You only have a short time with us today. So I look forward to hearing your proposals on the budget process. Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart, so very, very much. Good afternoon, all. It is wonderful to be able to join you today. I want to thank the Brookings Institution for hosting the event today and thank the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget for agreeing to co-sponsor this event. The scholars at Brookings and at the committee, as well as the National Budgeting Roundtable, have been part of the driving force in this town behind an effort to reform the congressional budget process. And I want to thank you so very, very much for lending your time and your expertise and your passion to this issue. Budgeting isn't something that usually fills up rooms, so we're very excited today to have a full room. Before I begin, I want to mention 3 specific items. One, I want to thank all of my budget staff who's here. They've done yeoman's work and incredible diligence in producing this product. And among those individuals is my colleague, Congressman Todd Rokita from the great state of Indiana, former Secretary of State, Vice Chair on the Budget Committee. Second is that I have a terrible cold, and I apologize for that, which is why I just did a Todd Rokita in slow motion. And I've got a lozenge in, and I apologize for that. If I cough in the middle of it, I'll take a sip and put another lozenge in. And the third is that, as Stuart mentioned, I received some interesting news yesterday that has changed my world and life and consequently my schedule. And so I'm really pleased and excited about being here today and presenting this, but I will not be able to stick around afterward for a Q&A, and I apologize for that. So we meet today less than 1 month after one of the most momentous presidential election outcomes most likely any of us have ever seen. A lot was said during the campaign, and a lot was said about the campaign. But one of the biggest takeaways that I see is this, and that is that the American people want change. They want real change. The American people are fully aware that government as we know it is not working well, and they want to shake things up in the system that we have here in Washington. There are many reasons why, and no one person and no one party is responsible for the good or the bad or the ugly that we see coming out of Washington. Let me submit, however, that a large portion of the gridlock that we see here in Congress between the legislative and the executive branches comes squarely from a broken budget process. The work is not getting done. It's not getting done on time, and certainly not in anything approaching an orderly or efficient or accountable manner. In the last 5 years, only one out of 60 appropriations bills has been passed on time before the end of the fiscal year. Now, the government has been fully funded only once in the past 20 years on time. To keep funding the government in 18 of the past 20 years, we've relied upon year-long continuing resolutions, basically a stopgap measure, or Congress has adopted and the president has signed omnibus bills. This is when Washington throws all of government spending into a giant package that is, by design, incredibly dense, challenging to comprehend in any expedient manner, and generally devoid of the level of transparency that the American people desire or expect. In short, no way to run a government. And it's occurred under Republican control, it's occurred under Democrat control, and it's occurred under divided government. It doesn't matter who controls the levers of power when the system is flawed. 2 years ago, when I sought the chairmanship of the House Budget Committee, I made it known to my colleagues in the House of Representatives that the overhaul of the 74 Congressional Budget Act was an absolute priority. And to that end, over these past 2 years, our committee has held as many as 9 hearings on this specific issue. We've received testimony from over 30 witnesses. We've produced numerous working papers, white papers that many of you have seen, I trust, and that that document the challenges that we face and the solutions that are possible. As members have become familiar with the process as it stands today, through the development of 2 budget resolutions and the ongoing appropriations process, there's been a near universal recognition that something has to change. At the core of our efforts have been 6 principles, which speak to not only the failures of the current system that we aim to fix, but also to the additional successes that we aim to achieve under a new and improved budget process. So today, I'm excited to provide an update on the progress that we've made in our committee toward achieving a substantial overhaul of the budget process, and to ask all of my colleagues in Congress, our friends in the policy community, the think tank community, who've thought long and hard about these issues, and the American people at large, to review the work that we've done and provide your feedback on these ideas. First, enhancing constitutional authority. Fittingly, we ought to begin any discussion on budget process reform where it all began, our Constitution. Article 1 of the Constitution gives Congress the power of the purse, the authority to determine the federal government's level of taxation and of spending. Over the course of many years and many Congresses, through both Republican and Democratic leadership, the legislative branch has ceded too much of its budgetary authority to the executive branch. We've given the president and their regime of regulators too much power, which has weakened the representative framework of our democracy. This has got to stop. First and foremost, when it comes to the budget of the United States, Congress should go first with its proposal. Under the budget process reforms that we envision, lawmakers will continue to consider a congressional budget resolution with information gained from a current services account estimate from the executive branch prior to the president submitting his or her request. Timing may seem like a small distinction, but the current scenario where Congress is essentially responding to the president's budget is completely backward and antithetical to the Constitution's goals and framework. Speaking of timing, we ought to align our fiscal year with our calendar year. That means that January 1st is when it would all begin. that will better reflect the schedule of Congress and provide policymakers with more time to get their work done. Further, we propose putting in place a plan to reduce spending on unauthorized programs. A substantial portion of federal spending goes to programs and agencies that Congress has failed to authorize for years, sometimes even decades. That's a fundamental failure of oversight. If Congress wants to spend money on an idea or an agency or a program, it ought to explicitly and in a timely manner declare and justify its intention to do so. Within this same framework falls the annual appropriations process and changes to the timing and design of how we keep the government regularly funded. Passing 12 individual appropriations bills all the way through Congress has, as I stated earlier, failed to occur rather consistently for quite some time. One solution that's garnered rather popular attention and acclaim is the idea of biennial budgeting, dropping the goal of approving 12 annual appropriations bills each year, and instead spending the first year of Congress dealing with budgetary matters and authorizing spending for 2 years so that the Congress can spend more time on oversight in the latter half of the two-year cycle. Biennial budgeting, while a popular concept, I don't believe will solve in and of itself all of our budgetary woes. However, the concept has received broad bipartisan support. What we propose is dividing 12 appropriations bills into two tranches. Six in the first year, six in the second year of the Congress. Each funding government functions in their area on a biennial basis. We ought to see how it works and reevaluate at a later date. And that review process should include the requirement that the Governmental Accountability Office prepare a report on the effectiveness of the biennial budget process. Meanwhile, a prohibition on long-term continuing resolutions is an absolute must. Congress should never forfeit its budgetary responsibilities by passing a stopgap measure that covers more than a year of governmental activity. At the same time, Congress ought to expand the use of its budgetary authority by allowing for multiple reconciliation bills to be considered under a single budget resolution, increasing the opportunity for policymakers to pursue multiple major reforms within each of the three reconciliation categories of spending, revenue, and debt. Second area, strengthening budget enforcement. Of course, a budget that is not enforced is worth less than the paper that it's printed upon. Right now, budget rules and restrictions are easily circumvented, often through gimmicks or outright waiving of enforcement measures. We should empower policymakers to prohibit such actions. There should be unequivocal opposition to any efforts by Congress to use gimmicks to declare it is offset spending when, in fact, it's done little more than clever accounting. We have to eliminate the opportunity for Congress to pursue spending and tax legislation when there's no budget in place. This not only makes sense from a budget enforcement perspective, but it also helps ensure that Congress is exercising its responsibility to establish broad fiscal policy in line with the priorities adopted by Congress. However, there can be no real budget enforcement if too much of the spending is outside of the purview of the budgeting process. Congress needs to look at the whole picture, so it's got a complete understanding of government spending and obligations. At the same time, we should broaden the base of programs that are subject to automatic budget enforcement procedures. And funding for emergencies should be truly that, funding for an emergency, for a defined, relatively short amount of time and not become a long-term line item in the budget. Third is reversing the bias toward higher spending. One of the more fundamental challenges that we face under the current budget process is the inherent bias in the system for ever higher spending. The baseline that Congress uses for its budget projections, the amount against which any change is measured or compared, assumes the government programs which are scheduled to expire and automatic spending programs like Medicare, which are headed for insolvency, are simply a part of permanent spending obligations and therefore do not have to be accounted for or subject to the same level of scrutiny as other federal spending measures. Meanwhile, programs funded annually through the regular appropriations process are automatically assumed to be given a pay raise due to inflation. This assumed automatic plus-up is unnecessary, and the baseline shouldn't prejudge congressional decision-making on spending increases. What is necessary for all lawmakers to consider is the cost of not just implementing a given program, but the cost of borrowing, if need be, to fund that program. Right now, interest payments on the government's debt is completely missing in the CBO cost estimates of new legislation, and we think it's important to change that. Additionally, committees considering legislation that will have an impact on the nation's fiscal outlook ought to have the estimate of the impact of that legislation in hand before they go to markup or approve or disapprove the legislation. Quite often, members don't have that information available to them on the costs of the potential legislation until it's too late in the process. Fourth, controlling automatic spending. For all the time and attention that they receive, the appropriations bills that Congress is supposed to pass each year represent only a fraction, and it's a decreasing fraction, of the government's annual spending. Two-thirds of current expenditures are dedicated to a relatively small number of automatic spending programs on the mandatory side, like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and other mandatory programs, which are not subject to annual appropriations and therefore operate largely outside of the control of Congress. In a few short years, over 75% of the annual budget will be consumed by automatic spending, meaning that Congress will have less and less control over the spending that occurs. That means that the American people will have less control over how their hard-earned tax dollars are being allocated. This is unwise, it's irresponsible, and it's unsustainable. To establish control over this spending, first and foremost, we ought to prohibit Congress from creating new automatic spending programs that are not included as part of the annual budget resolution. This doesn't preclude Congress from at some point agreeing to create a new automatic spending program, but it would ensure that the conversation begins within the context of a budget and the nation's fiscal health. Right now, there exists no reputable process in place to establish enforcing spending limits. Sure, we've got the statutory caps that are in place right now on discretionary spending, but they're not part of any long-term strategy for economic growth or for national security. Meanwhile, we have uncontrolled automatic spending programs that are eating up an ever-increasing percentage of yearly annual tax revenues. It's an unsustainable trajectory. We need a system that gives Congress the opportunity to establish spending limits and to put those limits into law, and to do so within the construct of the annual budget resolution. When Congress adopts a budget resolution to govern its appropriations process, there ought to be a way to spin off or an opportunity to send to the President for his or her signature a joint resolution that would put in law limits on spending based on the parameters that are established in that budget resolution. One way to lessen the burden automatic spending is placing on our budget is to bring back more programs under the umbrella of annual appropriations process. This could be done by establishing a commission, similar to the military's Base Realignment and Closure, or BRAC commission, that would evaluate each automatic spending programs and which ones ought to be transitioned over to the discretionary side of the ledger. Congress would then have the opportunity to vote up or down for or against the commission's recommendations. In each of these instances, Congress, the people's representatives, would have a say in the treatment of our automatic spending programs. That really is key, since many of these programs are critically important to the health and economic security of the American people. Fifth, increasing transparency. Nothing says good government like transparency, a little sunshine. A representative democracy must be open and accountable to the people, and that's why in our budget process reforms we put a premium on transparency. The American people should know where their tax dollars are being spent, and they should not have to be a budget analyst to figure it out. The Congress and the executive branch should provide a description of their budget to the general public in language that is easy to understand and scrutinize and searchable. We also believe in bringing the facts to Congress so that it acknowledges the reality of where our nation stands from a fiscal standpoint. That's why the reforms that we're proposing would require the Comptroller General of the United States to deliver an annual fiscal State of the Union address to Congress and the country, so we're all provided with regular updates on the significant challenges from a fiscal standpoint facing our nation. Transparency should also flow to those that are developing and implementing regulations. Every administration relies on regulations to implement its agenda and support the legislative work of Congress. Moving forward, however, we ought to account for the impact of those regulations, and that's why we're calling for a regulatory budget to catalog the cost of proposed regulations and the aggregate impact of the regulatory state on the health and well-being of our nation. And then finally, ensuring fiscal sustainability. While the budget process is on the surface about the year-to-year funding of the federal government's operations and agencies, the ultimate goal of any budget ought to be long-term financial stability, putting our nation on a financial trajectory that will ensure future generations inherit a country that is fiscally sound, economically confident, and globally competitive. Short-sighted thinking or short-term solutions will, by definition, fail to get us there, and that's where we currently are. That's why a new budget process ought to ensure the relative long-term fiscal health of the country by focusing on the nation's debt obligations over the coming decades. Specifically, we ought to adopt a series of long-term declining debt targets, enforceable by enhanced reconciliation. Should that fail, there must be an automatic enforcement mechanism so that we're putting ourselves on a path to ensure that we leave our kids and our grandkids a brighter future. The changes that are needed can be as simple as implementing a rule in law against increasing long-term spending. To the more complex reforms, like requiring risk-based discount rates when evaluating the government's credit or insurance programs, or to the revolutionary idea of changing the debt limit calculation to not a dollar value as a limit, as it is today, but the level of debt as a percentage of the economy, as a percentage of the gross domestic product. Short-sighted thinking in Washington is one of the biggest threats to ensuring a sustainable, healthy fiscal outlook. Anything and everything that we can do within the budget process to force policymakers to consider the long-term consequences of their actions and their decisions will go a long way toward ensuring America has a vibrant economy and a secure future. For all of our efforts to incorporate the input of members and policy experts from outside Congress, we recognize in this process that there will be other solutions that could contribute greatly to improving the nation's fiscal outlook. And that's why we propose establishing a special commission tasked with reviewing different budget concepts so that we're incorporating an outsider perspective into the conversation. Specifically, such a commission would examine and report to Congress on how portfolio budgeting and capital budgeting systems could be implemented at the federal level and how they might ultimately foster balancing the budget. The ideas that I've discussed here and others are included in a discussion draft for budget process reform that our committee is releasing today, and each of you will have the opportunity to pick up a copy on your way out. We invite anyone and everyone to share their insights and input and to take part in this important initiative. There are items within our proposal that are certainly controversial or may elicit serious concerns, and that's fine. That's healthy. We ought to have that discussion. We welcome any and all feedback. At the end of the day, our motivation is not the process, but the product. How do we create a system of checks and balances that will ensure we are producing solutions that make our government more efficient, effective, and accountable to the American people? The congressional budget process is really just a means to an end. The end is a nation that is fiscally sound, economically healthy, safe and secure, and full of opportunity. And today's budget process is failing the American people and our nation. And we must and we can turn that page. And hopefully this proposal provides the impetus for getting us moving in a better direction. Let me once again thank Brookings and the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget for their sponsorship and inviting me today. Thank you so much. God bless.
Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for laying out these very comprehensive proposals. And as you said, there are copies at the back for everybody to have a look at when they come out, when they leave. I know you have to leave, and I know you have time for just one quick question from the moderator. I know also that given that this early stage in the nomination process, it can't be about HHS or healthcare. So let me ask you this. You have been the driving force on the House side of discussions of budget process reform, as evidenced from your comments here today. If things go as you hope, you will be through the process, and you will be leaving the Congress and the committee. In that eventuality, how can you assure us that the momentum for budget process reform is going to continue in the House?
It's a great question, and the good news is that this isn't just a Tom Price effort. This effort grew from frustration, literally on both sides of the aisle, about the budget process. There isn't anybody that's happy with what's been happening from an appropriations and budget process in Congress over the past couple of decades. And so the work product that we've produced today is from our committee staff and the input that we had from members and from folks in the think tank community and ideas that we had. But we're not wedded to just that, and that's the good news, because what we want is the input from everybody. I believe that there will be somebody, if I'm given the privilege of moving to a different position, that there will be somebody or buddies in the House of Representatives who will pick up the mantle. This is so important. This is so incredibly important. The House Republican Conference has embraced the idea of budget process reform. And so I have all the confidence in the world that what will happen moving forward is that hopefully this will begin that serious discussion so that within the next 2 years we'll be able to have a piece of legislation that we can move through the Congress of the United States.
Good. Well, I hope you're right about that. And thank you again for coming this afternoon.
Thank you all. Thank you. Take care. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it.
If you would please be seated while remain seated for a moment. I now have great pleasure in handing over to Maya McGuinness of the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, who's, the co-host of this meeting today. And please, if the panelists will start to come up, and Maya. Maya has been in charge of the committee since 2003, and she's focused on budget process issues and the budget and economic issues for many, many years, not just at the committee, but at the New America Foundation and earlier at the Brookings Institution. So I'm pleased to hand over to her to conduct the panel. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Stuart, for putting this panel together. Okay, camera people, you cannot leave. I know you're here for budget process. Great to have so many cameras interested in budget process. Okay, well, I'm really excited to lead the discussion with a great panel, but also really a great product from Dr. Price and his staff from the Budget Committee that's here, that's put together something I really think is worth discussing. Many, many times budget process, I'm going to be honest, is used to avoid talking about the policies. A lot of people use it to avoid actually confronting the fiscal policies that we're going to have to grapple with. And that's not the case in this process, I believe. It's actually put together. I think the other thing that you sometimes see with budget process is it becomes kind of a random grab bag of just all sorts of ideas that have been sitting on shelves for two decades. They throw them in there. But this is actually, I think, and I'll be interested to hear what the panel thinks, kind of a thought out whole process where the budget would be looked at more comprehensively. And it's a chance to address some of the questions that Dr. Price brought up, whether it's missed deadlines, to gimmicks, to poor fiscal outcomes. And so I think there's a real method to it, and I think it's the beginning of confronting all of those policies. I also think that Dr. Price has a lot of credibility on this because he's also worked deeply in the policies that are affected by the parts of the budget that he's looking at to reform. So it's not instead of, it's an addition to, and I think he has a lot of credibility on that. So we have a great panel today. We're also going to have time to have a discussion with the audience because I see a lot of budget experts here today. So I'm just going to quickly go down. I think everybody knows who we have, but James Wallner from the Heritage Foundation, Harry Stein from the Center on American Progress, Phil Joyce from the University of Maryland Public Policy School, and David Wessel from here at Brookings. Also, this is the kind of moderator I am. I'm going to ask those broad questions, and I encourage you to answer whatever question you wish you'd been asked instead of the specific one. I think we should just have a discussion, and I think you guys should jump in and talk with each other as well. But I guess I would start with, it is important when you're thinking about budget process, what problem are you trying to solve? So, and there are plenty of people who say, you know, it's not the process that's the problem. It's the, what did they say?
The problem's the problem,
not the people. I almost blamed on the people, sorry. It's the problem that's the problem. I think there's a lot of problems with the process. But do you think the process needs to be reformed? And what are the biggest problems that you would want to solve through budget process reform? And we'll start with James.
Well, first, thank you to Brookings, Stuart, and Maya, and the committee for a responsible federal budget. I want to commend Chairman Price and the Budget Committee for putting together a great proposal. There's a lot of really good ideas there, a lot of refreshing stuff to see. You know, I would just start off by saying I might be one of the people who thinks that the process is a bit of the problem, but the people or the problem is also the problem, so maybe it's good to start with me. I'd like to just take a step back and share with you how I try to approach these issues and assess the future effectiveness of any proposed reforms. And I think that does require us first asking, what do we mean when we think about and talk about the budget process? And for me, that's just a set of rules and procedures that governs how Congress makes fiscal decisions, at least in theory, right? And it comes from the same place that all of the other rules in Congress come from, Article 1, Section 5 of the Rules of Proceedings Clause in the Constitution. And the reason why I think that's important is that the implication of this is that factors that are negatively impacting the budget process should also show up elsewhere. And I think if we were to ask any of you in the audience, you would likely say that nothing in how Congress is making decisions today is actually working very well. And I think that's not a coincidence. I think a lot of the same factors that are negatively impacting the budget process are negatively impacting the legislative process more generally. This reflects, I think, a more general inability to form sufficient coalitions that are willing to take the votes necessary to pass public policy on a sustained basis. I mean, that's the fundamental problem we're looking at today. So it isn't a rules problem per se, although that's certainly part of it, and I think the rules can be more rational and more efficient, but it's a problem of political will. Pure and simple, that's it. And the reason why we're talking about budget process reform so much lately is the problem has gotten bigger and it's gotten harder for members of Congress in both parties to show some sort of willingness to tackle that problem. And so here we are. I would just say that the effectiveness of these proposed reforms should be assessed in this light. That doesn't mean that that reforms that don't increase the political, the cost of ignoring the problem are bad, but it's not necessarily going to solve the problem. So biennial budgeting, it makes a lot of sense, but we're not passing appropriations bills in the House and Senate for a lack of time. I mean, I think it's important to keep that in mind. Broadening the programs that are subject to automatic budget enforcement, also a very good idea, but the current automatic budget enforcement of the Budget Control Act on a narrower subset of less salient programs isn't being allowed to go into effect. We typically waive it. It's another thing to keep in mind. So again, these problems I think are very important. They're very good proposed reforms to tackle the problems we have, but we need to keep in the back of our mind that it's a fundamental lack of political will on both sides of the aisle to tackle the long-term fiscal problems of this country that is leading us to have this discussion.
Great, thank you. Harry.
I think it's a good question. And I think that, to me, when I look at budget process reform, I don't think that fundamentally the budget process is the problem. I think that the budget process currently can work when members of Congress want it to work and when they're able to work together. Now, that said, there are certainly issues with the budget process, and there's ways to make it work better. I think that one example in here that I think is positive from Chairman Price's proposals is eliminating the term limits for members of the Budget Committee. I honestly did not know that rank-and-file members of the Budget Committee were term-limited. I think that generally term limits make it harder for members to build expertise on the issues that they work on, and I think that's a good first step, and hopefully it leads towards getting rid of the term limits more generally on committee chairmen as well in the House, which I think would, for the same reason, be a positive step forward. But the fundamental thing that I want to ask on budget process reform and government reform more generally is, does this make government more responsive, accountable, and transparent for the American people? As Chairman Price said, we just had an election where it's very clear that people feel like Washington isn't hearing them, and they want to do things differently. And, I think it's important to note here that there's actually some very good political science research that shows that those people are right. Martin Gillins and Benjamin Page did a study a few years ago looking at this, and there's this really depressing quote in there that after you control for the preferences of wealthy Americans and the preferences of interest groups, ordinary Americans seem to have absolutely no impact, at least nothing statistically significant or observable, on public policy. And that's just should be phenomenally depressing, and we should have a budget process that works to solve that problem. Now, unfortunately, and I think the most important of Price's proposals, I think that this is going in the wrong direction, and this was the having caps on debt as a share of the economy that decline over time and are enforced by across-the-board spending cuts. So basically sequestration, but sequestration for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Those programs are extremely popular with the American people. The American people support expansion over cuts for Social Security. They support protecting Medicare, overcutting Medicare to reduce the deficit. The wealthiest Americans have the opposite opinion. They tend to support cuts over expansion. They tend to support cuts to Medicare to reduce the deficit. Now, people can disagree on this from a policy standpoint, but that's where people stand. And we should note here, there's no fiscal arithmetic that forces cuts to these programs. You can stabilize the debt as a share of the economy over the next 30 years entirely with tax increases, and we would still be a low-tax country by international standards. Now, you don't have to support that policy, but to say that we have to cut Medicare because of fiscal math is simply not true. And what worries me about what Chairman Price has laid out here is it sets up a system where members of Congress can vote for large tax cuts, and then they can vote to reduce the debt, and they never actually have to vote on cutting Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. So, for example, President-elect Trump has proposed tax cuts that cost roughly $6 trillion over 10 years. I ran the math on this during the election. Paying for those with an across-the-board cut requires $1.7 trillion in cuts to Social Security, $1.1 trillion in cuts to Medicare. You would reduce the average monthly Social Security benefit, which is only about $1,200 a month. You would reduce that by about $170 a month. So these are people with disabilities, retirees on fixed incomes, and you're going to take away $168 a month from a very low amount of money that they have. Again, people can disagree on the policy of that, but they should have to vote on that. And what this is doing is it's creating a process where the accountability for that choice is divorced from the people who are making it. And I think that's a fundamental mistake for budget process reform.
Great.
So I'll start by just not amplifying very much, but just saying I agree with the prior two speakers that the fundamental problem that we have is not primarily a problem with the structure of the budget process. It's a problem with the operation of the budget process, which does not mean that there are not reforms of the budget process that could create incentives for the budget process to operate in a sort of different and more timely way. The second thing I will say is that this is a serious effort. There were these nine hearings that were held, and I testified at three of those hearings, which is not what makes it a serious effort, by the way, but it doesn't hurt. And
the other six hearings were horrible.
Right, exactly, right. I'm not sure if I'm three of the 30 witnesses or only one, but my point is that, you know, based on the number of members that were in attendance, the kinds of questions that were asked, you know, this was a serious effort, and I think this is, as Maya suggested, a proposal that hangs together, which doesn't necessarily mean you need to agree with all of it. It simply means that, you know, often you do get a sort of hodgepodge of different ideas that are thrown together as if they are a unified proposal. I actually think this is a unified proposal. If I were going to identify the things, you know, and I think some of them are things that this proposal really does address that are the most fundamental problems with the budget process, I guess I could list, you know, 10 or 15, but I'll stop with two. And those two would be the timeliness of the process. And I think if we want to talk about trust in government, why would the citizens trust a government that has only managed to enact appropriation bills on time four times in the last 41 years? They may not know exactly what's going on, but every time a new spate of stories comes out about how we have to have a budget agreement on appropriation bills by X date or we're going to have a government shutdown, at some point it doesn't matter whether we actually have a government shutdown or not. It's a sort of demonstration that the Congress and the President can't do their job. So to the extent that anything in here is creating incentives for the Congress to actually get its work done on time, I think that's actually the most important thing that could be done. The second is on this question of whether we should have targets or not. I think the question of where the target should be, as Harry suggests, there should be a lot of debate on that. The question about whether there should be a target, I'm sort of on the side of saying that we ought to know where we're trying to get to, and that a lot of countries around the world have what's usually referred to as a fiscal rule. And a fiscal rule simply means that we have an overall sort of macro level goal for where we want the budget to get to. And whether that's debt as a percentage of GDP or something else, it would be useful to know where we are trying to head. And then there can be all kinds of debates about how it is that we get there. We don't necessarily have to get there by cutting spending. We could get there by increasing taxes. But if you had some kind of consensus, which we lack, and we have lacked for a long time, on what the overall goal for the budget process ought to be, I think that would move us a long way toward at least knowing where we're trying to get to and then figuring out how we're going to get there. And I'll stop there and save my other comments for later.
Well, thank you all. I'm tempted to say I agree with everything and we should go home. The reason we worry about this is not because the process is messy. If we had a budget outcome that we were more comfortable with, we would tolerate a messy process. I think a lot of us are uncomfortable with a process, as Congressman Trice said, where an increasing fraction of the federal budget is kind of on autopilot, although I think, contrary to what the chairman said, Congress can and often does tinker with Medicare and Medicaid, so it's not like they really don't have any power. But in general, too much of the budget is not getting annually reviewed, and too much of the pressure on the budget are things that we think of as investments in the future. So there is a problem with the outcome, which then should lead us to look at the process. Secondly, I do think that if Congress wanted to make the current process work, they could. And I think it's nice but naive to think if we had just different rules, and some of these are very complicated, that somehow Congress would say, aha, well, we really meant to play by the rules. Now that you've made them complicated and a little bit stricter and put all these laws in place, that now we're going to behave. I just don't think it's going to work that way. Third, I do think that Congressman Price and the people who worked on this thing did identify a number of issues that really need to be addressed. And one of them, as has been said, is our absolute lack of long-term focus, which I don't look at as necessarily a question of too much spending or too little spending, but just that we don't seem to be able to look beyond the next, you know, Congress thinks they've succeeded if they avoid a shutdown. Does not seem like a very high bar for a representative democracy. Phil and I and a number of other people have done a little book on the thinking more about the long term that we're going to discuss tomorrow at the Bipartisan Policy Center. And so I think that they're right to focus on this. But, you know, we had the luxury of being able to look through this. To say I studied it would be a strong exaggeration. And I just want to pick on a couple of things to call them to your attention. One is, it's very nice to say that if we move the start of the budget year until January 1st, that would give Congress more time and they would work better. Let's remember that Congress moved the deadline, the beginning of the fiscal year, from June 1st to September 1st because they said it would give them more time. And so I'm a little skeptical that if you move the thing 3 months, that suddenly everything will be an orderly process. I'm trying to imagine what election time would be like in years where they hadn't finished the budget. Do we have this bizarre situation where they're refusing to vote on things because they don't want to do it before the election? So I'm worried about that. Secondly, I'm trying to imagine President Trump coming into office and being told, by the way, boss, you can't do anything about spending and taxes for 2017. And for half the appropriation bills, you can't do anything for 2018. I don't think the president would be happy with that. That obviously isn't Congressman Price's concern, at least not for a couple of weeks. But I don't actually think the American people would be. I think when the American people have a presidential election and the president runs on a program, they don't want to be told, oh, because we set up this rule, they can't do anything for 2 years. And then just one more thing, Maya, and then because there are some other issues that are really interesting and important in here. But one of them is Congressman Price, when he talked to us about the budget process, was very clear that he was looking for a neutral process, one that was not sort of pro-Republican or pro-Democrat. And I worry about whether we've really achieved that here. And I make two observations. One is, if you define the process, and Harry pointed this out, as too much spending, and you basically bias the thing against raising taxes, even if people in America would be willing to pay more taxes to get more spending, then you don't have a neutral process. And secondly, I feel like this is a nice conversation, but completely divorced from reality, when it looks like, according to Leader McCarthy and others, Congress is just going to repeal the ACA with one reconciliation bill and do a big tax cut with another reconciliation bill so they don't have to really deal with getting dealing with very many Democrats in the Senate. So it kind of feels like we're going to talk about this nice process, but before we put this in place, we're going to dismantle much of President Obama's doing and half of the New Deal on the way, and then we'd like to have this level playing field thing. So I think that it's a little bit in contrast with the spirit of the times, which seemed to be, I won the presidency, the Republicans have the majority in Congress, we're going to do stuff, and the Democrats better get out of the way because we found a way, one that the Democrats have used successfully, I would admit, to avoid needing to get a bipartisan consensus.
Okay, a lot of good thoughts there. I have a couple I'm going to share, but just so you know, my next two questions coming at you all will be, one, is there something you really think we should do the budget process that isn't in here that you would recommend? For instance, you all talked about long-term budgeting, other things you'd want to see more of. And two, I'd like to dive a little bit deeper into the issues of baselines, which is one of the pieces that's interesting in this. Just a couple thoughts as I was listening to all of you with really good comments. One thought I had is that actually I think after this election, it's a really important time in this country for rules and institutions and things and systems that people feel are fair, because we have a more polarized, partisan, really tough environment than I think any of us have seen in quite some time. And we need people to have faith in the processes of government, even as our politicians are kind of figuring out how they're going to work through things together. And so I think the importance of budget process being something that is understood and followed on a regular basis is critically important. So I actually think this is maybe a tough time to get it done, but a potentially really important time for a very strong budget process. And when I was thinking about what the most important priorities that you'd want it to address are, one, I'm not sure, this one may, it may address this, I'm not sure, but a whole piece of budgeting that I think is really missing is evaluating our national priorities and figuring out what our biggest priorities are. Portfolio budgeting is one area that they talked about, which I think would go forward and address that. And I think if you have baselines that are less biased in one direction or another, that gives you more choices and more chance to revisit the national priorities. But I would love to see a process that focuses budgeting on what it's supposed to do, establish what your national priorities are, put in place a plan for them, put in place a plan to fund them. So I think this does this somewhat, maybe could do it more. The other one that I have obviously concern about is the fiscal outcomes. And I am really interested in the debt targets as a piece of this. I think the debt targets, I agree, and I'll talk about this in a minute with your concerns, Harry, but I think having a fiscal target to start with, exactly like you said, Phil, it's a necessary part of a budget. It seems to me kind of crazy to try to put budgets out there that don't have any place where they're going. There's no forcing mechanisms for even evaluating trade-offs then, which are exactly what budgets are supposed to do. And just like having debt targets as a share of GDP is important, I really like that it switches the debt ceiling to look at debt as a share of GDP, which is the right way to think about it, I think. But I think having the sequester-like, if you fail to hit your debt targets, it's only spending cuts. I'm all for broadening the base. I don't think putting Medicare and Social Security in there is a bad thing. I think it's part of what needs to happen along with revenues. You can have two kinds of sequesters. One where you have a punishment that nobody wants. Both sides want to avoid it, so they're incentivized to fix it. We thought we had that with the sequester. It turns out we didn't, so maybe we don't understand what people are willing to do to not make those hard choices. Or two, to have a sequester that would actually get to those debt targets through a reasonable method. But I certainly think having kind of a biased, a one-sided approach to fixing it if you miss your debt targets doesn't make any sense at all. And I thought Harry's explanation of you could have huge tax cuts and then never vote for it, but cuts in entitlement spending would not make this very plausible to begin with. And you want budget rules to be bipartisan. You want both sides to adopt them and both sides to think that the rules are fair. And then they get in and more likely to abide by them. But I do think it's a really interesting time for a whole fresh start for a budget process. It's not necessarily even that the process would be so much better than the old one. If we followed it, the old one would be fine. But sometimes you just need a reset. And it feels like in the budget, you need a major reset right now. Okay, so back to questions. What do you wish that what the committee did include or would include? They seem very open to other ideas as well. And if you have any thoughts on baselines, which is something that's been debated for many, many years. Love to hear them.
I think it's a great question. The committee did put out a white paper, a working paper on this. I think it was a very helpful paper as well. I just want to take a step back, and I think you're absolutely right. I think we should think big, at least in terms of assessing what kind of system we want. There's no reason to necessarily be bound by the existing status quo. But this requires us to think through what kind of process we want, what kind of things we value. There's a tension between, do you want a more deliberative decision-making process that may be politically and electorally perilous for its members? They got to take tough votes, right? But it does deliberate. It does arrive at stable outcomes. But it's going to be more difficult to get change, and it may take a while. Or do you want a less deliberative, more secretive process that protects members politically and electorally, encourages them to take some of these tougher decisions? But, and yes, you may get decisions more quickly, but they're going to be less stable and maybe more one-sided. But the fundamental problem that we have right now, and again, it's not just budget, it's within all areas in Congress, in my opinion, is that, and I think you see this in the election and what motivated millions of Americans around this country, is that they're not seeing their claims adjudicated in the halls of Congress, on the floors of the House and Senate. They're just not seeing it. They're being told lots of stuff when their politicians, when their candidates are there asking for their votes. But when it comes to Congress, they're told, well, we can't do this because this will happen, or we can't do that because that bad thing will happen, and all this other stuff. And it's frustrating. And so I think having this, you know, thinking through this process, and it may not be the most glamorous thing, but I do think it's important that we think through what kind of process we want and what kind of things we value. And yes, it may make members of Congress a little less secure electorally. But the last time I checked, this place wasn't designed, Congress wasn't designed so that members could come back year and year and year on an easy basis. It's designed to represent the people. And I think it's clear that the people aren't getting what they want right now. So I would just leave it at that.
I think you asked a good question. I'm going to let someone else weigh in on the baselines. I have some thoughts on it, but I trust the other people more. I think one thing I really like, which I said, is to have some kind of long-term goal. But I don't think it's sufficient to say we have a long-term goal of debt to GDP and everything else doesn't matter. So, for instance, in the Australian long-term budget review thing, they talk about goals for other things as well. And I think it's important to put the budget in the context of economic policy in general, because the goal is not to have only, and Congressman Price said this very well at the end, it's not only to have a fiscally sustainable budget. It's to have a growing economy and equal opportunity for social mobility and stuff. So I think if we're going to do long-term planning, we have to have something more than just say all that matters is the debt to GDP. The second thing, and one thing that worries me a little bit, and I confess I don't quite understand all the mechanisms here, so I may be being a little bit unfair, but we've learned the hard way that automatic stabilizers in the budget are really important. That you want some spending that expands when the economy hits a rough spot and then contracts when the economy gets better. We have some automatic stabilizers. I think some of us feel that one of the lessons of the Great Recession is we didn't have enough, and that we ought to be thinking about expanding those, because you can't count on Congress to do fiscal stimulus when it's needed. And also, this stuff doesn't always trigger off when the economy gets better. So I would want to make sure that any budget process we didn't stop us from using federal programs as automatic stabilizers. That is, more people are going to be on food stamps when we have a great recession, and more people are going to be on Medicaid when we have a great recession. And we might want to think about creative ways to get more monies to state and local governments to offset the cutbacks when their revenues go down. If you think of everything as we got to put a cap on everything because otherwise it's out of control, I worry that we will be setting ourselves up to make the business cycle much more severe than it is. And it invites then Congress to, you hope that Congress will waive those things when we have another great recession, but I'm not sure that that's actually going to put us in a better place.
And I just want to say to the staff of the Budget Committee that if there are things where you feel like, oh my gosh, I need to clarify how this works at any point, just flag me and you can jump in and say, oh, we do have automatic stabilizer. We have ways that during recessions there's outs for this. Because I know in other countries when they have these kinds of targets, they certainly take the business cycle into account. Good points.
Yeah, it's always a really fun day when a CAP staffer gets to agree with something that the Heritage Foundation said. And the point that...
Does this happen often to you, Harry?
I've had less fun days than I used to have, I suppose. But one thing that I think is really important is the idea that the process should... People should be able to see the process adjudicating competing claims, and they don't see that enough. One thing that I think that is important in these discussions is that Probably it needs to be broader beyond budget process and to think overall about congressional process. I think a lot of the problem with not seeing claims adjudicated is when amendments aren't allowed, and so there's just one vote and members have no opportunity to offer amendments. This is not a partisan problem. Republicans shut Democrats out. Democrats shut Republicans out of the amendment process. But I think it is a problem for governance. I think that I have no objection, and I think it absolutely is a good thing to be clear when you're discussing your budget what your fiscal goal is and what your other goals are. And when the president's budget comes out, you can see in there where his budget would go with debt as a share of the economy over time. And when Congress puts its budget out, you can see where at least their totals go. There's less policy behind a budget resolution, but the fiscal goal that they're trying to reach. And you can see also under current law where we're going now. And that's a good thing. Where I think you don't see claims adjudicated well and where the process starts to break down is when you start divorcing those questions from the question of how we get there. And that, to me, is the problem with an enforceable goal with any sort of automatic procedures. I mean, I think certainly, you know, it's a much more biased goal when it's only across-the-board spending cuts. But, you know, I don't want to see across-the-board tax increases either. I want to see members of Congress think through the tax code and identify policies that work to get to the fiscal situation and to support the government that they want to support. And when you divorce these decisions from each other, it's easy to vote for a goal and then say, we'll figure out later how to get there. And at the core of a lot of this is, I think, this theory that Congress doesn't compromise because they're not being forced to enough. And I think that's probably incorrect. And in fact, we tested this. We tested this, as Maya alluded to, with the sequester, where and actually before that even, in 2011, President Obama, I think it was a mistake to do this, used the debt limit as an opportunity to try to force a grand bargain on debt reduction. That didn't work. Instead, we got the Budget Control Act, which had discretionary spending caps, which aren't really doesn't really address the drivers of the debt. And then the sequester process that was supposed to be so horrible that it would force the super committee to design something better, they didn't. We got sequester instead. I don't really think sequester for Social Security, Medicare, or for that matter, middle-class taxes is a great way to go in the future. And so something that I wish I did see in here, I do agree that thinking about debt as a share of GDP is the way to think about it. And it's good to see Chairman Price and the Budget Committee thinking about ways to make the debt limit more rational. I would be concerned with doing that in a world where you're in a recession and GDP is shrinking, you may hit the debt limit even if you don't increase debt in nominal terms. And so you're increasing the likelihood of a default crisis at exactly the worst time to be dealing with that. What I would much rather see here, there's no reason for the debt limit. There's no purpose that serves. If you vote for spending and you vote for revenue policies, there shouldn't be any question that you're then going to pay the bill when those come due. And it used to be that the debt limit was basically a way to embarrass the party in charge, but ultimately we always passed the debt limit. And it changed into something that was actually taken as a hostage, frankly, where there was something then that you had to get in return. That's, I think, very dangerous. We almost defaulted several times in the last couple of years, and I think that we need to just get out of that situation, not just for the next administration, but for future administrations, and whether that means abolishing the concept of the debt limit altogether, or going to some sort of rule where I think Senator McConnell has done this in the past, where the president can authorize a debt limit increase without Congress. Congress has an opportunity to disapprove, but there's no hostage taking, there's no brinksmanship. And I think, again, you're linking the decisions about spending, revenue, and debt together rather than saying we're going to have a vote just on debt without acknowledging the policies that got us there.
Let me, just before you go in, because I want to just disagree with you on one thing, because I think it's more interesting to have a panel where there's some exciting disagreement. But I think I disagree with you, and I may be wrong, but I don't think Congress does make many hard decisions unless they're forced to these days. I fear that the way we legislate is by last minute or almost crisis. And so I think sometimes what we're trying to do is create action-forcing moments. And if you look at, like, last year, I wasn't fans of either of the bills because they added to the debt tremendously, but we had an SGR fix and we had tax extenders. Those only came because deadlines were hitting. Again, we added to the debt in them, so I wasn't the biggest fan. But I'm trying to think of when recently Congress has made any hard choices, fiscal improvements, without some kind of forcing mechanism.
So I think that most Americans, and we talked about trust and confidence in government, don't want to see more SGRs, more fiscal cliffs, more threats of government shutdowns or defaults. And it's, I think, actually been quite a positive thing that over the course of the Obama administration, enough of these cliffs have been resolved that we no longer have to have two budget baselines. We just have one baseline, and that works. There's no longer a need for an alternative fiscal scenario. And I hope that it stays that way, that current law is basically reflective of where we think we're going to, where we think current laws actually are. To give an example for where Congress has made tough choices without being forced to, the Affordable Care Act. This was a law that there was no forcing mechanism there, but it expanded health insurance coverage. 20 million more people have health insurance, and hard choices were made to pay for that. The law reduced deficits. It's, in fact, done that, and those, that deficit reduction grows over time. An amazing thing is between the Affordable Care Act and the overall slowdown in healthcare cost growth, which seems to be at least partially due to the ACA, but also just the reforms that the ACA made directly in Medicare in particular, total spending on federal health programs in 2016 is less than CBO thought it was going to be in 2009. Now think about how amazing that is. In 2009, we're just talking about Medicare and Medicaid. So now we've got Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act and a huge coverage expansion, and we're spending less money than we thought we would in covering 20 million more people. And that made, that required hard choices. I just saw an ad today encouraging Congress to repeal demonstration programs that are being done under the Affordable Care Act. And the advocates of the Affordable Care Act took a lot of flack for the cuts in Medicare that were made in that law. I think that, that what you saw there were genuinely hard choices. And people can oppose those choices and oppose the Affordable Care Act, but I think that that represented real lawmaking when Congress had a desire to do it.
Bill, and then I'm going to hope to get the congressman to weigh in if he wants to.
The only one in Congress here.
Yeah. So in terms of, just following up on that directly, in terms of things that I would do differently or things that I would add to this that aren't here, one of them does have to do with the debt ceiling. And I agree completely with Harry that I would just get rid of the debt ceiling. And whatever we think about action forcing mechanisms and whether they're a good thing, playing Russian roulette with the U.S. economy is not a good action forcing mechanism. So, you know, I think what they're doing here is a sort of step in the right direction, but I would go all the way and just get rid of the debt ceiling. The second thing I would do, which goes a little further than what they're going here, is I like the idea of not having term limits for budget committee members. I would go further. I've suggested elsewhere making what are now the budget committees committees on national priorities and have them include the chairs and ranking members of the other major committees in the Congress. I mean, I think it's actually a good thing if what are now the budget committees are going to be setting priorities for the Congress, then they ought to include the people who have the most stake in that, and I think those are the chairs and ranking members of the committees. The third thing that is not directly addressed here and might be addressed by the Commission on Budget Concepts, which, by the way, I think is a great idea, is I don't see any mention of tax expenditures here. Yeah. And I think that focusing on tax expenditures, focusing on the transparency of tax expenditures, which are now way less transparent than spending. We can do things through the tax code, and nobody knows that we've done it, whereas spending is very transparent. I would like to see that addressed more directly. I did want to take you up on your offer to say something about baselines. Because, and I'm gonna do something that may just be telling of the time I spent at CBO, but I'm going to defend baselines. And I think the things that are said here may be true, which is that there may be some tendency for baselines to sort of drive spending up. But I think baselines serve a useful purpose, and that useful purpose is answering the question, what are we actually doing in terms of our ability to finance current policy? Many of the same people who want to get rid of baselines also, I think, would say if we froze the defense budget in nominal terms from this year to next year, that we would have less defense capability next year than we have this year. And that, to me, is the purpose of a baseline, is saying how much would it cost us to continue to do the same things that we're doing now. And so in that sense, baselines are a very useful concept. They're not unique to the Congress and to the federal government. This is a standard thing to do in budgeting, to ask the question, how much is it going to cost us next year to continue doing the things that we're doing right now?
Okay, so baselines as is. And David, still no comments on baselines for you.
No, I agree. I agree with that. I think that to say that we're not going to adjust the baseline for inflation is basically not use the most economically meaningful way of measuring what current services are.
Do we have mics for questions and answers? So, I'm going to go ahead and force you to answer something that you wish you'd been asked, and then we'll open it up for Q&A.
I want to thank everyone for being here. Todd Rokita, Vice Chairman of the Budget Committee, and speaking perhaps on behalf of the staff, I would concur with Dr. Price. You know, this is a serious effort, as you say. I suspect it's going to be a permanent effort. Speaking as a rank and file person in Congress, basically, there is a lot of energy behind this and a lot of interest to get it done. Knowing that this is a discussion draft, and I appreciate everyone's feedback so far, and I appreciate the questions that are sure to come. There might be stuff added to this by rank and file and others. There might be stuff taken away. Regarding the term limits and appointments, let's remember that the Budget Committee didn't exist before the Budget Act of 74. And my term of art is true budgeteer. I've been in Congress since I came in the wave of 2011, and I've been on the committee for 6 years. I intend to stay, not as an appointment of another committee. And that might be something that I might want to add to it. Not only do we got to get rid of the term limits, but maybe we got to have a true budget committee, sans appointments. I don't know that would go far, but I think that would, because remember the appointments were there to make sure that the budget committee, this new creature, didn't get too out of hand.
You mean the appointments made by the Rules Committee and Ways and Means?
Correct, and appropriations, I believe. Right. But definitely with, appreciate your comments on getting rid of term limits, on the debt ceiling and on deadlines generally. I mean, let's not forget Congress is a reflection of you. Everyone sat here and talked about Congress in the third person, but we are a reflection of the country, and guess what? We're human. And because we're human, we react to deadlines just like each of you do in your professional academic career. So I think deadlines, to your point, Ms. Moderator, are a good thing. And with regard to the debt ceiling, I don't look at it as holding things hostage. I don't look at it as reckless. I look at it as forcing us to the table. And perhaps we wouldn't need a debt ceiling if we weren't the world's reserve currency, if we were limited in that sense. But because we can print money at will, and because we are least ugliest at the dance, the world dance, which, and who knows if that's going to change or not, we get away with a lot more than others do. And I think a debt ceiling, or perhaps there's other ideas and reforms for it, and I love the ideas and reforms that are in here, are a way to approach it, but I think they're needed. And with regard to tax expenditures and the bias towards getting spending down and your fear that we're not going to appropriately address tax expenditures, otherwise known as confiscations of people's property, I would say that when you look at the debt ceiling and see the debt trajectory and see that it's near vertical, I'd love to see your numbers, but I disagree with them, Harry, that you can tax people enough. Yeah, you can tax people enough to stabilize the debt for the next couple years, but not ultimately. In fact, I believe you can confiscate 100% of the value of people produce in goods and services, and at a point you're still not going to be able to pay off the debt or get it down to a reasonable level without reforming the spending. So from a congressman's perspective, that's how we're coming at this, not from to bias up one political ideology over another, but to address what we see as ultimately the real problem, which is spending, not revenue. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions that people want to jump in right now? Okay, I see a hand back there. Yes, you. Mike is coming to you. And introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Metin. I'm just a student in the area. I have a quick question, but just before that, I wanted to jump in response to what the congressman just said. I deeply respect and appreciate all your years of service for both your constituents and the American people, but I take a slight offense with sort of the comparison of this budget deadline in comparison to normal budget deadlines. I think, the sort of like we're human sort of sounds like an excuse for such an important thing, as was mentioned at the beginning. This is one of the most important things that Congress does. So that was just a quick note. But I was wondering if the panelists could talk about the political realities of increasing the number of discretionary categories. I don't appreciate that so much of the spending is outside of the purview of the budget process, but I worry that increasing it just adds to an already complicated process that seems to barely get done as it is. Thank you.
I'm trying to remember if when I was just a student, I even knew about discretionary spending. So.
I would just say that with regard to the number of discretionary bills, I mean, we're talking about 12. There's nothing magical or holy about 12 appropriations bills. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind, too. I mean, we really need to step outside the box and think through, how we structure these decisions. I think that deadlines are good. I think that the debt ceiling represents an inflection point that forces people both out in the country and their representatives in Congress to make these tough decisions. And as long as those are made in a very transparent way, I think that's a good thing. And we need more of that kind of stuff. And I think that basically we need more conflict in the budget process, I think. But it's important how that conflict is arrived at. It needs to be open and transparent so that people can see what their representatives are doing, what they're advocating for, and how they're voting on things. And then they can weigh in on the back end and say, yes, we love Congressman X because he voted for Y. Or no, we really don't like him and we think he should not come back. Congress doesn't give them that option, in part because they're not demanding it. So it's not just Congress's fault. I would completely agree with that. And I think there's a lot of good proposals in here that help increase transparency in the process that can help to achieve that kind of debate. But until we have that kind of debate, none of this stuff matters. It just doesn't. It's not going to get anywhere because Congress is going to keep responding to the signals that the people are sending them, which is to not take these tough decisions.
I think there's one thing we should point out that's directly responsive to your question that, you know, people may not know that's in here, which is that this would establish a commission to recommend converting mandatory spending programs to discretionary programs. And so you can say whatever you like about that idea. And, of course, we don't know which programs, whether that's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, we would wait for the commission. But if you want conflict in the budget process, that'll get it for you. If you have to debate every year what the sort of level of spending is going to be for Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security, you will have your wish.
And I would just say one other thing. You speak to a capacity issue, and this definitely gets you conflict. It's been done once before, although for the wrong reasons at the turn of the 20th century. But the Appropriations Committee doesn't need to have responsibility for every discretionary bill. We may not even need an Appropriations Committee. There's nothing magical that the appropriators appropriate and the authorizers authorize. At the turn of the 20th century, the House and Senate, the Senate, got rid of the Appropriations Committee and gave a subcommittee on appropriations to each of the authorizing committees. Now, I'm not sure if that's the best way forward or not, but these are the kinds of things that we need to think through when we are trying to design a system that can speak to the problems that we have to address.
I used to work for a member of the Appropriations Committee, so I wasn't sure what authorizing committees were.
You would like to authorize as well.
Right.
God, what a lame room where that's a funny joke, just by the way. Are we? Please, go on.
I think that it's worth backing up, though, and saying, why is this the case? Why are more resources flowing through mandatory spending and also tax expenditures? One reason is that Congress has decided years ago to establish programs that do that. So, you know, I get a little bit annoyed when I see pie charts that start in 1965 and then go to 2015 and say, wow, mandatory spending's really grown. Well, we passed Medicare and Medicaid in 1965. I mean, unless the argument here is we shouldn't have Medicare and Medicaid, like that's what's going on. Now, there's also some mandatory programs that could very easily be discretionary. There's also some discretionary programs that could probably be mandatory, that basically Congress just funds them year to year based on whatever's needed on more or less an entitlement basis. And so I think it's worth figuring out, is there a way to rationalize that? But I think the reason that you're seeing more spending go through more programs go through the mandatory side is because Congress has enacted caps on discretionary spending that are too low. And because they've done that, the money finds a way. And one way that it does that is that if you're saying, okay, we want more money for medical research, well, there's just not enough money under the spending caps right now for discretionary spending to do that. So we have to make it mandatory if we're going to be sure that money's actually going to make it to institutions like NIH. And this is also the concern with tax expenditures. If you have caps on discretionary spending that don't reflect national needs, and then if you have caps on mandatory spending that make it harder to do things through the mandatory side of the budget, there's always tax breaks. And in fact, you see Congress doing this anyway. And again, I think Congressman's right that this is a reflection of the American people. To the extent that people have an aversion to spending, but they want to see things done, tax breaks are a way to provide government resources to particular activities and claim to not be increasing spending. I don't think there's a functional difference between whether a government subsidy is handed out via a spending program or a tax break. The main concern here with tax breaks is that they tend to be skewed towards those at the top just because of the nature of the tax code. But there's nothing inherently wrong with tax breaks where they make sense. But the point that Phil made is absolutely right. They tend to get a lot less scrutiny and be done with a lot less transparency than spending programs. And so I'd be very nervous about a system where the only way for Congress to respond to the needs of the American people is with more tax breaks.
Stuart Butler and I will be publishing a paper shortly that tries to think about how you get at a compromise on this, which is not that mandatory spending would be treated as discretionary spending and authorized and appropriated every year, but also wouldn't go unchecked as it does now unless there's a proactive effort to do something, where you would actually have to consider the budget, look at the long-term budget, take an affirmative vote to approve where things are, and regularly go back and check that the track is one that Congress approves of. So Congress would kind of own at least this trajectory instead of having it go. And on this, we would also include tax expenditures, meaning the deductions, exemptions, exclusions, those things that are about $1 trillion worth of lost revenue because they are built into the tax code and they're more like spending programs. So I'm not sure that we have all the details figured out, but it's one of those ideas that I think it builds off a big project that was done here where a number of people from Brookings and Heritage and others came up with this idea to take more ownership of that portion of the budget. Is there another question? Yes, right there.
Thank you. My name is Sister Rochelle Friedman. I work for the Coalition on Human Needs. I feel like whenever we talk about budget, there's one big looming thing that we don't acknowledge. There is a lot of very well-funded big efforts in this country and a whole group of people that believe we need a smaller government. Therefore, we have a sense that this group loves it when people take a no-new tax pledge. I'm not going to raise taxes. For many of us who work in the low-income community, we know that the safety nets are so critical to people in our nation that are really hurting. And so I just want to say that it grieves me greatly that a lot of these well-funded efforts are making real headway into our government and into people's minds. Even when I look at people who voted for our president-elect, a lot of those people, I think, voted, frankly, against their own best self-interest and fed right into that smaller government concept. But we need government to do some things that charities can't do and that people, many of them, can't do for themselves.
Question for the panel on top of that?
I would just appreciate any comment or feedback.
I think that's such an important point. And so often when we have these conversations about budget, we divorce them from the actual people and the actual things that we're talking about. And I think that when that's done, and this is what I meant in my opening comments, I think that that's a world when we're having a conversation that only an audience at the Brookings Institution understands. That's a world where the wealthy and special interests and well-funded groups can influence the process to the greatest extent, when the American people don't really understand what's going on here. If the presentation is instead, here's my idea to cut Social Security and Medicare and safety net programs, I think that the American people view that very differently than here's my presentation on how to reduce the long-term debt enforced by automatic spending cuts. But they're functionally the same conversation. It's just one the American people understand and the other one they don't. And I think that whenever we can make the budget conversation about real people, that's where this should be. And even when we're talking about process, even when this gets arcane, the more that it's about real people, and to go to the point about, you know, that a lot of this is low tax or no tax groups. I mean, so here's the numbers behind the point I made earlier. Right now, we're the fifth lowest taxed country among advanced economies, according to the IMF, fifth out of 35. And by the way, some of the ones that are below us are things like Hong Kong and Singapore. which are naturally not terribly comparable anyway. Our 30-year fiscal gap, according to CBO, is 1.7% of GDP. So if we reduce the annual budget deficit by 1.7% of GDP, debt to GDP in 2046 equals the same amount that it does now. If we were to do that deficit reduction entirely with tax increases, and you don't have to, but if we did that, our tax burden would be the sixth lowest out of the 35 advanced economies that the IMF looks at. So there's, I mean, not to say that that's not going to be a meaningful change in tax burdens, but it's simply not true that we can't still have human needs programs, Social Security, and Medicare. It's a relatively modest tax increase in the context of where other advanced economies are.
But I think that what concerns me is I don't think we can do this all on the spending side, and I don't think we can do it all on the tax side. I think it's going to take both. I think pretty much everybody knows that. What concerns me is that we don't want to have a process that allows one of two really bad outcomes. You can have low taxes and high spending. That's a bad outcome. And you can have the opposite. But the trouble is we need to find a way to match our spending and our taxes. And what the budget process is about is saying to people, if we want to have these programs, and many of us do, then we have to be willing to pay the taxes to support them. And if we're not willing to pay the taxes to support them, then we have to accept less government. And what the budget process has allowed to happen is a divergence and getting that unsustainable thing. And so that's where I think this whole exercise is about, trying to force that choice. People have different tastes about whether they want to have a smaller government, lower taxes, bigger government, higher taxes. But we have to find a way to make that decision in a way that's more orderly than we do now.
And just to kind of concur with that, sort of the people, connecting this to people is incredibly important, but people want Social Security and Medicare, and they also don't want a huge debt, and they also don't want huge taxes. And so the question is how you have all those questions put together. And just on you can do it all in taxes, which I think you can, but I think the argument, if I understood it there, that you gave probably was a little bit misleading, because to stabilize the debt where it is today is, of course, twice what it has been on average in this country as a share of the economy. So that might not be the fiscal goal that everybody would pick. But I would agree that revenues could get you there at some point. They'd have to keep going up, though, to keep up with health care.
So two quick things. And I don't mean to advocate that should be the solution. And in fact, and I agree that you can do, I think, especially make more progress on the health care side. Repealing the Affordable Care Act, by the way, would be going in exactly the wrong direction, given how slowly healthcare costs have been growing. But the point is that even if you did it entirely on the tax side, which I don't think you have to do, you can still sustain all these programs. There's no need to dismantle them to get to something
approaching
sustainability.
But I think we're all saying that you want a budget process where those choices are transparent and actually made.
But I would say that you need to make that needs to be connected to what decisions are you actually making. And just setting a goal without saying, and here's how we get there, disconnects that one piece of this debt, which everyone, would you like more or less debt? Sure, less, from how do you get there. On the question of how much debt reduction to do, when to do it, what the appropriate level of debt to GDP is, let's remember these are questions that very smart economists disagree on. And there are reasonable arguments out there that a slower adjustment to the debt to GDP ratio from its current path is actually the right course. The former CBO director Doug Elmendorf and Louise Schiner did a paper on just this point. Other economists disagree, but I think that makes sense for the political system to hash out based on what people want. And people have been clear on this. When you ask them, do you want to cut Social Security and Medicare to reduce the deficit, unless you're one of the wealthiest Americans, you tend to say no.
Question back there, and I'm going to make one more comment on that because it just got me thinking, is we're switching from what we thought was going to be more of a Democratic, probably more of a Democratic White House to a Republican White House. One of the things you often see is people arguing for different debt trajectories depending on what policies will get us there. So my guess is a lot of people who said it's okay to have a higher debt level when they thought it was going to come from more spending may not be as sympathetic to that debt trajectory if it comes from tax cuts, and vice versa. Fiscal hypocrisy is not above us. So I just think we should
it's
across the board. So we should try to remember that everybody loves increasing the debt when it's for their favorite programs. Oh, we have an expert who wants to weigh in. Jim.
Wait for the mic.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to let Jim...
I have
Jim
a loud voice, so I probably don't need this.
Yes, but not for people who are watching on TV.
There's cameras everywhere,
just
Jim.
A few technical issues on the proposal. On the pro-cyclicality, there are a number of ways that we would address that. First of all, we would retain procedures for low growth. We would retain procedures for a conflict, the ability to suspend any limits. And furthermore, when we talk about everything being in play, we're not necessarily saying that any enforcement has to be across the board, some uniform percentage. We're not precluding Congress from making decisions that some programs, you know, shouldn't be proportionately addressed. You know, we're just simply saying that everything should be part of the dialogue and the discussion on the budget. We shouldn't artificially pass a law and say some program's off budget that is part of what we do. It has an impact on capital markets. We're saying it should all be part of the discussion. On the debt targets, I just want to emphasize the fact that by virtue of the fact that we've highlighted these debt targets, we're being neutral as to how Congress gets there, what the fiscal policy is, what the mix of discretionary mandatory revenue changes are. We're not prejudging that. We're simply saying we're putting in a marker that in of that.
Jim, hold the mic towards your mouth.
Okay. Another thing on the when we talk about the debt limit. I want to point out that part of this proposal is that as long as Congress and the federal government as a whole are within the targets that are established by law, there is no need to raise the debt limit. So it's going in the direction of yeah. what some of you have just advocated. You know, it is sort of a medium. I mean, it still leaves Congress with the ability, if they wanted to change the debt level up or down. But this is sort of predicated on the assumption Congress and the President agree to a trajectory, and if they do and they stay within that trajectory, they shouldn't have to continually act to raise the debt limit. And on the baseline, you know, you focused on the discretionary side of the baseline and whether it was realistic to assume that discretionary spending is held flat. Well, the concept that's in law is supposed to be current law, and that is, you know, we reflect spending and revenue levels at what they are in law, and, you know, in a pure current law perspective, appropriations would be zero, and obviously we don't think that's realistic, and we think it's a closer approximation of what current law is to leave it at what the most recent level that Congress enacted. And I think what's really important to look at is what we do on the mandatory side of the equation. And on the mandatory with respect to the baseline, because here all we're saying is that we should have parity in the baseline. You want it to reflect, you know, likely trajectory of what'll happen if you don't change policy, but you don't want to have in rules like we do now that have separate rules for treating revenue that expires and spending that expires. And all we're saying is they ought to be treated on a comparable basis. And we do it one way. You could do it another way. But we're simply saying that there needs to be parity. So there's not, I don't think there's a bias in there. And then the last point is on the discretionary and the mandatory. All we're saying is that there should be the ability to address spending to the extent that you can on a comparable basis. Symmetry, mandatory and discretionary. We don't have the symmetry with mandatories that we do now with discretionary. And we're simply coming up with a device. This is similar to what Gene Sterley and Rudy Penner have talked about. Developing a process where we can look at mandatories on an annual basis. It doesn't prejudge where we set that. We're not saying they have to be set here as opposed to there. We're simply saying Congress should have some comparable basis to be able to look at both sides of the equation. And for appropriations alumni, I might point out that in our process where many of these mandatory programs look, walk, and talk like a discretionary program, but they're mandatory because they're funded outside the limits, we would hold those harmless. We're saying maybe those programs should be moved to the discretionary side, but we're presuming there would be an adjustment in the resources for that. The point isn't to squeeze out those priorities. You know, it's simply to put them in a box where as much as we can, all funding is part of a set of trade-offs in the federal budget process.
Okay, we have,
and I talk too much, and my boss is giving me a dirty
look. We have negative time, and I'm sorry if I made you stand up and sit down.
Sit up.
For a quick question, and we'll do quick answers.
I'm Carl Polzer, and I'm one of the people. So if we're going to think long-term about the budget, 10, 20, 30 years, it's a good idea. Shouldn't that be there be an alignment between what you're talking about and where the rubber hits the road? And that's when Congress looks at a bill and does a cost estimate of the legislation. And, you know, the 10-year window they now use. Shouldn't they be asked to do maybe not the same kind of analysis in detail, but some thinking about a longer term, especially if they anticipate, like, the kind of issues as a policy consultant that I work on, long-term care, retirement. You know, and I was going to give the example of the CLASS Act, which funded 7% of the ACA, which was generated money for 10 years, and then it blew up as an unactuarially sound program. That could have used a little bit of
So great, you'll great be happy question. With page 23, which has a rule against long-term spending and suggests that CBO look out 40 years before it does any kind of increase in mandatory spending. So I'm glad I won't have to do a 40-year estimate of anything at CBO, but the committee is definitely thinking along those lines.
Yeah, well, let me just add to that as an alumnus of CBO that should worry them, and B that there is a long history that the further out you go, the more uncertain the estimates become. So we have to be careful that we're not basing policy on bad numbers.
And I would think CBO does that with second decade estimates on things where that's particularly relevant, immigration reform, and I think the ACA also. And they rather than doing year by year because of this issue, they'll do a 10-year lump sum score, and I think it's a good approach in cases where it makes sense.
Okay. Thank you so much to our audience for coming. Thank you to our panel, and thank you for Stuart and Brookings.